So I just want to start by saying thank you to Occupy. In New York and across the continent and those of you here in Vancouver. And I say that because I feel grateful for what you've done. I'm not someone, just to be clear, who is one of the local organizers. I attended a few events. But as somebody who, and this is true for all of us, I think, at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, as somebody who has plugged away at this stuff for years, you know, doing work on climate justice and on poverty reduction, and in particular on inequality, you know, we've been looking at these numbers for years, and in particular publishing stuff highlighting the growing gap, and not just the growing gap, but it was 4 or 5 years ago that we published a report called The Rich and the Rest of Us. Because what the data was telling us was it wasn't just a gap between the rich and the poor, it was a phenomenon of the runaway rich, the runaway top 1%. And then earlier this year, a number of months before Occupy, we published a paper titled The Rise of Canada's Top 1%. And so we've been plugging away at this stuff and, you know, trying to do what we can do. And let me just say this. And it's not easy. Occupy has accomplished more in a few short weeks than we have in years. When it comes to fundamentally shifting the conversation and just taking the issue of corporate power and inequality in particular and just having them explode into the public conversation, and I watch it and I marvel at it. We've always understood at the CCPA that fundamentally what our project is about shifting political culture, about telling people that we can take better care of one another and the environment, and we can rise to the challenge of climate change, and we can protect our public services, and we can eliminate poverty. And one way or another, these hopes that we harbor for a better world are still realistic and realizable. What's happened in the last 2 months with Occupy has just ramped that right up. And I think there's a lesson in that for all of us, which is so often, I think, particularly those of us who've been at this for a while, we set these constraints based on what we understand the current political reality to be. And if there's a lesson in this, it's just that you never know. What it's going to be that's going to be this tipping point, and that suddenly that which seemed politically impossible is suddenly possible, and the whole thing's up in the air again. And I think what's happened has just been invigorating for people because, in particular, it's just broken through people's feeling of isolation, that the outrage that they feel about these trends is shared by many, many others. And that has been done, and it's captured people's imagination in the way that it's unfolded, and it's been done in a peaceful way, and particularly in many U.S. cities where there has been violence. The violence has really been the monopoly of the police, and in a way that has allowed this movement to just capture this moral authority. But I think I was tasked to speak specifically to the question of inequality and solutions there. Probably already eating off way too much of my time. You know, it started in the States, and then a month later it came to Canada. And, you know, in the States, it brought to the fore this whole question of corporate power and inequality. And then when it came to Canada, you got this, for a little while, you got this, or even still, this narrative that, oh, well, that's the States, Canada is different. And there are some things that are different. We haven't seen the foreclosures at the scale that they've seen in the United States. There is more poverty and inequality in the United States. There is a higher unemployment rate in the United States. But we have nothing to be smug about. And it may be that inequality is greater in the United States than in Canada. But it is growing more quickly here in Canada. And when you look at the boom years of the 10 years before the recession hit in Canada, we saw this incredible concentration, again, where a third of the income growth went to the top 1% here in Canada. And our corporations in Canada have been sitting on mountains of cash, $500 billion right now, that they are not investing, and it's not going towards job creation, despite the fact that they have been the beneficiaries of humongous tax cuts. Now, you call that a bailout? I don't know. I mean, it was it amounts to the same thing, more or less. And our government's economic plans continue to be fundamentally at odds with the reality of climate change, and we see that in what Harsha was talking about in terms of a whole economic strategy, notwithstanding all of the talk about getting serious about greenhouse gases, that is all about the extraction and export of coal and shale gas and et cetera. Here in British Columbia, we've also done work on the top 1%. And in fact, in the summer, and I brought along a few copies of it, we published a paper that looked at what's happened to the BC tax system overall over the 10 years between 2000 and 2010. And what has emerged in that period is just an out-and-out shift in taxation from corporations onto households, and within households among upper-income households to middle- and modest-income households, such that what we are left with is an overall tax system that is just straight regressive, which is an economic term, which means very simply, the more you make, the lower your overall tax rate in British Columbia. I'm not talking about income taxes. We're looking at the whole of taxes when I say this. Income, property, sales, MSP premiums, the works. In fact, so much so, our provincial government now derives more income from sales tax than we do from income tax. We derive more money from MSP premiums, the most regressive tax there is, than we do from corporate income taxes. That is the BC income tax regime. And for the top 1%, when you look at what they paid in taxes in 2000 compared to what they pay in taxes in 2010, the value of the Liberal government tax cuts to that top 1% of British Columbia households has been, on average, $41,000 a year, the value of the tax cuts. How is it $41,000? It's $41,000 because in that same 10 years, the top 1% of British Columbia households saw their average income go from about $600,000 a year to $820,000 a year. So it actually doesn't take that much of a tax cut to be worth $41,000 for you. Most of this is not about taxes, too. This is about the market producing more and more inequality. And instead of government systems of taxes and transfers mitigating that, it's been piling on and exacerbating that inequality. How am I doing? Good time. So in terms of solutions, though, because we like to try to live up to our name at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and talk about solutions. And we focus a lot on poverty reduction and on inequality, and the two are very intertwined. They're different, but they're intertwined. They're intertwined culturally, too, because what the research around the world tells us is that the societies with the most inequality also abide the highest rates of poverty. It separates us, so that we no longer feel that solidarity with one another. And in very concrete terms, the more inequality there is in a society, the more upper-income households are bidding up the price of essential things, especially housing, which has an impact on affordability right down the chain. But, you know, with the media narrative on Occupy, there's always been this talk, oh, but what are the solutions? You're like, what's it for? I mean, there's no shortage of solutions. There's no mystery to this in straight policy terms. You know, we need a comprehensive policy strategy that would end poverty at the bottom, increase economic security in the middle, and redistribute a heck of a lot more income at the top. I mean, that's pretty much it. What is that? Well, so what is that? What do those pieces look like in a little more detail? It looks like substantial increases in income transfers for those in low income. It means boosting employment standards for vulnerable workers. It means rethinking the whole use of temporary foreign workers, as Harsha was talking about. It means transforming community health care for low-income seniors and people with disabilities and mental health and addiction issues. It means public child care, which is a huge benefit right through the low and right through most of the middle-income range. It means a provincial and national housing plan. It means a whole host of education and training and apprenticeship measures. It means getting more of our employers, public and private, and cities and school boards to become living wage employers, which is a big campaign that we're a part of with First Call and other parties. On the tax front, one of the things that we've been calling for and are hoping others will as well, so that's about poverty reduction and living wage campaigns. But on the tax front, we've been talking about the need for a full, fair tax commission. You know, not just a referendum like we had on a single tax. Put the whole regime that I was talking about, the whole regime on the table, and have a deliberative process, something Occupy started to model for us in different experimental ways, a whole deliberative process that asks the question, what do we want to pay for together? And then how do we raise the money to do that in the most fair and equitable way? But there's all manner of options there. You know, capital gains income in Canada is only taxed at 50%. It's ridiculous. If we had an upper income tax bracket that was the same as the United States, which is higher than ours, for the top 1%, so increase it by 3%, $2 billion a year. We published a paper last year looking at modeling different forms of financial transaction taxes in Canada, and a whole range of them with the potential to raise easily as much as $10 billion a year. The corporate income taxes in Canada, which are now among the lowest in the OECD, the corporate tax rate since the year 2000 has gone from 29% to 15%, right? And yet it has delivered nothing out of that. They're sitting on $500 billion of cash that they haven't invested, which was the whole object of the exercise, the promise if we went that route. If we simply restored corporate income taxes to the rates that prevailed just a few years ago, 2007, that's another $14 billion in income for us to rise to the challenges before us. That's federal. But provincially too, I think on the Fair Tax Commission, I would say that's something that we need to see now. You asked us just to start to say, you know, what's the role of this movement now in starting to speak to those things? I mean, I've given a taste of some of the specific things that I think we should collectively be calling for. But this is about a political cultural project, which is what Occupy has given such a huge boost to already, about the conversation that we have with our friends and coworkers and family and so on. And I think we need to do it creatively. I've particularly, you know, of the things that I watched, I was particularly captivated by the bank transfer day, because this was a way, you know, the U.S. credit unions claim that about $4.5 billion in assets came to them when people left their banks and came to the credit unions because of that day. But also, it was a way in which thousands of people, about 600,000 Americans, who couldn't get down to an Occupy site, could concretely show their agreement and do something concrete. So I think there ought to be, and I'm, you know, I'm a policy guy, I'm not a strategist, I'm no good at this, but I think that there are creative ways out there in which we out the corporations that are paying little or no taxes, in which we out the corporations, particularly in the fossil fuel sector, that are driving a political agenda, that we can do that in creative and fun ways. One of the young guys some of us have worked with in town, Sean Devlin, who did the Shit Harper Did videos, is down in New York working with the Yes Men now on this Occupy the Boardroom thing where you can go and adopt a CEO and become BBFs and pen pals with various Yeah. So, but fundamentally too, just to take this to the next level, we're trying to reach, in saying all of these things, we're trying to reshift the balance of power between us and corporations. And some of that can be done through just policy measures, but let's not kid ourselves. It's not something that would be welcomed. And so part of the solution is developing those economic alternatives, those social pools of finance that are alternative sources of capital investment, whether they're credit unions or pension funds or co-ops or what have you, or crown corporations, so that when we say to corporations, here are the rules, here's what you're going to have to pay in taxes, here are the labor standards, here are the environmental standards, and they say, no, not interested, we can say, okay, see you later. We can do this ourselves. Thanks.